you like listening to those ads, or would you rather hear an ad-free version of The Gist? Well, it's your lucky day, because in the lab, we've developed such an animal. It's like the vegan meat of podcasting. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com to become an ad-free subscriber, or choose from other tiers with additional bonus content. And they all taste like chicken. Enjoy the show. It's Friday, December 6th, 2024. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. You know, they say this was the podcast election. I gotta say, I have a podcast and I voted, so they might be right. But it was definitely a sort of podcast, disappointing podcast, post-election. And what happened was, I turned to my podcastial friends, and I wanted to listen to the panel discussion shows, the group shows, where the alchemy of their agreements and disagreements, their shared conversations, would result in more insight. And I could not find that. I did not find that. There were smart people talking all throughout the podcast dial. But it is so, so rare to find anything other than three people agreeing. Sometimes, I'll be fair, sometimes it's four people agreeing. But what happens is podcasters almost know just general, hey, we're a bunch of smart people who might not agree on everything podcast. No, they're siloed. So you have your Republican podcast, and you have your Democratic podcast, and you have your socialist podcast, and you even have sub-niches thereof. So when I listen to the Editor's Roundtable or the Commentary podcast, conservatives who mostly voted, I think, still for Trump, if not totally voted for Trump, you get one set of virtually in total agreement analysis. And then if you listen to the left-leaning podcasts, you get a different bunch of analysis. They're usually in agreement. If your side loses, it's the message. If their side loses, it's the policy. So that usually happens. But there's not the cross-pollination, and I have to do it myself, and I have to pick up an idea that Tim Miller said in a Bulwark podcast and marry it to something maybe Ezra Klein said on Pod Save America. I know he's not one of them, but he was interviewed by them. And then eventually maybe I get to a theory of what happened. It's not just the election. It's the nominations. It's what is Trump going to do next time? Depending on what podcast discussion group you're listening to, Trump either has an enemies list, everyone agrees, or the idea that Trump has an enemies list is just ridiculous. Everyone agrees. I haven't heard the one where someone said, well, you know, Trump's enemies list. And then someone else on the podcast said, what are you talking about? But, you know, there used to be a podcast like this. There used to be a podcast that was based on the cross-pollination and the disagreement and the not even getting mad. In fact, it was titled Not Even Mad. Where did that podcast go? Well, it went where many beautiful things go to die. It went in our podcast feeds, never to be refreshed again, until now. Today I bring back Not Even Mad. There are two new panelists who we never had on before. I think they're great. We're going to start playing Not Even Mad here within the Gist feed. I also, in case you've still been refreshing it for a year and a half, I put the current iteration in the old Not Even Mad feed. And we're even going to have video. A video option shall be made available, because apparently there is a bunch of people who hear people disagreeing and they don't believe it. They need to see it. So that will be made available to you as well. But now the reboot of a few people who are disputatious, never discourteous, but not even mad. Hello, and welcome back once more to the reconstituted, and let us not say better than ever, but just as unmad as ever, not even mad. Today we shall speak of the Hunter Biden pardon and all the explanations for the Democrats' failure. Wait, there was another one. Oh, we just missed one at the time I started talking in this sentence. We will uphold our reputation for refutation and vow to be not even mad. I say we, We have a new we. Who are we? Michael A. Cohen is a columnist for MSNBC, a senior fellow and co-director of the Afghanistan Assumptions Project at the Center for Strategic Studies at Tufts. What assumptions are we still making about Afghanistan, Michael?
Well, it's all the wrong ones that we made for 20 years when we were fighting a war there.
There are no new wrong assumptions? Can't we at least get some new wrong assumptions?
There are actually a few wrong assumptions, but we're more focused on the past than on the present these days.
Liz Wolf is an editor at Reason Magazine and formerly managing editor of The Federalist. She's the host of the Just Asking Questions podcast, now as a spin-off YouTube channel. Liz, what is the greatest joy of Just Asking Questions?
The greatest joy of Just Asking Questions is that I am shockingly not fired yet. I wake up each morning with a job, absolutely thrilled. No, they really give us super long leash to interview all kinds of people, whether it's sparring a little bit with Glenn Greenwald or we just had Brianna Wu on. Sometimes we have much more conservative and libertarian people, like we just had Dave Smith on. I really like that we're given this long leash to engage with all kinds of people. And thus far, I've only gotten into a shouting match with, like, I think Brian Johnson, the sort of crazy transhumanist. But we got to ask him about his nighttime erections, which he measures. So that was fun.
Is that what engendered the shouting? No, Brian, they're hardly that impressive.
No, so the thing that engendered the shouting, I got very philosophical with him because he's a life extensionist. And I was just like, why are you so afraid of dying? Like, what's the problem? Like, I got the sense
that you believe in the afterlife and he probably doesn't.
Exactly. I got the sense that he's running from something and I really wanted to get to the bottom of that. And turns out he did not want to disclose to all of my YouTube viewers what he was running from.
Interesting. Well, I hope this show will be as interesting as that. And I will start with this quote. Today, I signed a pardon for my son, Hunter, from the day I took office. I said I would not interfere with the Justice Department's decision-making, and I kept my word even as I have watched my son being selectively and unfairly prosecuted. Liz, how many lies do you count in that sentence?
It's honestly, the thing that's so wild about this is for those keeping track at home, not only has Joe Biden been claiming for, I think, years at this point that he is not going to exercise his pardon power in this way, but also, I think we would take the entire hour of the show if we attempted to count up all of the different media cheerleaders of Joe Biden who have also backed or credulously sort of recycled that lie. I mean, look, I would feel a little bit differently about this if Biden had stayed agnostic on this earlier in his tenure. But the fact of the matter is, this is a very late in the game reverse. It looks like he's running out of time to, like, buy his kid a Christmas gift, and he's just attempting to, like, throw some stuff in at the very end of his term. It's profoundly wrong. And I think I would be less offended by it if it were a pardon that didn't cover 10 years dating back to 2014, which for keen observers is when Hunter started working with Burisma. So I would feel better if the pardon were more specific versus spanning a whole decade. And I would feel better if Biden were in any way actually deeply changing his tune about the underlying crime here. One of the things that he keeps citing, which is Hunter lying about his drug use on a form to purchase a firearm legally. I mean, if that is actually a crime that Biden doesn't think should be a crime, then he ought to be consistent about that, but he should not be giving preferential treatment to his son. I think it's really bad politics, and I think it's really bad parenting.
Right. So, Michael, I guess he would argue that it's not the one, he's not the one giving preferential treatment. It was the Justice Department giving whatever the opposite of preferential, you know, I guess he would say unfairly prosecutorial treatment.
Well, here's the thing. I can't really disagree with anything that Liz just said.
The show's not going to work then.
And yet, I just think that I'm very empathetic to what Biden did in pardoning his son. And I do think that that Hunter Biden has been attacked for 4 years by Republicans in ways that I think are really unfair to him and unfair to Biden's family. I think that I don't know if he was singled out for prosecution. It does seem from what I've read that some of these charges would not have been brought if his last name was not Biden. But I think, you know, Liz makes a fair point that that Biden said, 6 months ago, repeatedly, I'm not going to pardon him. And then he, of course, turns around and he does it. It does feel hypocritical. It does feel like a betrayal. But I guess my feeling on this is his son. He is his father. This family has experienced untold suffering. Biden has lost two kids. And I just think that, you know, I can imagine does not want to see his son, who has struggled his entire life with drugs and alcohol, go to prison. And I understand that, and I empathize with that. And so while I can sort of say from an enormous perspective, I don't like what Biden did, I have a hard time condemning him, just because I do think that there are a lot of extenuating circumstances here. And look, here's the other thing, too. And you're right, Liz, about going back to 2014 seems a little bit, as my kids would say, sus. But the issue is that you just appointed, I mean, Trump just appointed this guy, Kash Patel, to run the FBI, who has an enemies list. Look, I'm not an expert on criminal justice, but it seems to me that having a director of a law enforcement agency with an enemies list is bad. And I think it's fair to believe that it with Patel at the FBI and with Pam Bondi at DOJ, that there's going to be more prosecutions and more in-depth investigations of Hunter Biden. So I do understand why Biden did this. I'd like to see him use that pardon power to help other people who've been unfairly targeted. But I just struggle to condemn him for this. I really do.
Well, isn't it enabling him, though, right? I mean, we're not talking about a 30-year-old drug addict here who maybe is being forced into treatment by his family members for the first time. We're talking about a 54-year-old who, yes, has some mighty demons for very understandable reasons. But to what degree, like, I mean, do you see this as good parenting?
I got to go back and forth in this. The fact is that, you know, Hunter Biden has been sober for several years now. I mean, he has tried to turn his life around. The things he was prosecuted for happened in the past, happened when he was addicted to drugs and alcohol. I sympathize with the idea that if he's sent to prison, it could lead him to fall back into addiction. Part of me sort of feels like I have to, you know, kind of respect or empathize with where Biden is and what he knows about his own son. I understand that as the president, his responsibility is beyond his own family. And those should be predominant. I believe me, I get that. And I agree with your point about this. But he is also a father. And I think it is very hard to separate those two things in his position, especially knowing, you know, his son better than we do and knowing what could be the triggers to cause him to, you know, fall back into addiction. So I take your point about enabling. But I do think, you know, he deserves some credit, Hunter Biden does, for being sober for several years now.
Hunter Biden's sobriety, I think, should not be our concern. And if Joe Biden wants to not just hurt his legacy, but really sully so many of the statements of his defenders about his rectitude, and in contrast to how corrupt Trump is, he definitely did that. Maybe you're right that familial fealty is the explanation for this decision, but is it an understandable decision or a really disastrous decision? Not just in terms of what we think of Joe Biden, but what Joe Biden is really saying about the original investigations into Hunter. If Hunter really was corrupt and prosecutorially corrupt during Burisma, if that corruption possibly redounds to Biden himself. I think he gave all of us a lot less faith to have in the justice system. And Trump is doing it, or we fear that the Appendix B of Kash Patel's government gangsters will wind up being an enemies list, not a justification for this. Now, look, if Joe Biden wants to say whatever you want from me or about me, or tell me that it's you think less of me as a president, I don't care. My number one priority is to my son. I mean, that is the sort of hubristic and fatal flaw in the Greek tragic sense that powerful figures often say. And I can judge him for that. I mean, I guess you'd say you understand it. I understand it, just like we understand why, you know, Sophocles wrote what he wrote. But I think it's something close to a horror show. And I'm not just disappointed. I think he's really fundamentally sullied the rule of law. Am I taking it too far, do you think?
I mean, for me, you have. I mean, I don't know if I think it's disastrous. I think it sullies the rule of law. I think that already happened on election night when you know, tens of millions of Americans elected a convicted felon to be our next president.
But how does that sully the rule of law? I mean, you can make the analogy that pardons are acceptable by law, voting for candidates are acceptable by law.
Well, it suggests that Trump will face no accountability for his actions, which I don't think is really a positive outcome, particularly his actions to try to overthrow an election. I mean, I think the thing is that I'm not gonna fight on this hill. I do struggle to defend what Biden did. I think that for me, I feel, you know, somewhat sympathetic to why he did it, empathetic to why he did it, considering just the risks to not just Hunter Biden, but a lot of people around Biden who I think are going to get targeted by the Trump administration and the Trump DOJ. I don't really buy this argument. I mean, I do think it undermines the rule of law, but, you know, that train has left the station, I had to say, and left the station with this particular president. President-elect, I should say.
What I wonder about is the rebuttal to Trump and Trumpism and coming in with something akin to an enemies list is that they unfairly prosecuted not just Hunter, but the entire investigation into Joe Biden and firing prosecutors was an unfair justification. And therefore, we have to be very worried about this because these guys are going to trample through the trees of justice to get at the devil, as it were. But this does make me question that entire premise. How unfair an investigation was it if what Joe Biden does to protect himself from it is extend a pardon that goes all the way back to 2014?
Yeah, I mean, this, I think, is the thing that's really frustrating about this, right? The 2014 date is not an accident. And the thing that I am worried about in particular is the degree to which this could almost be read as an admission of guilt on Joe Biden's part, or an attempt to shield multiple members of his family from possible investigations into corruption and influence peddling and other forms of wrongdoing. I mean, in a sense, this is a lot more serious, I think, than the tax evasion charges or than the firearm gun related or the firearm drug related charges. In a sense, what it looks like they kind of might be doing is attempting to get off scot-free from the Burisma stuff. And to me, at least, I just find it to be... I just think that this is kind of the unanswered thing. Like, I have yet to hear a satisfactory answer from somebody sort of defending Biden's decision. In fact, maybe, Michael, maybe it's your time to shine here. But, like, why not have a more limited pardon related to these? I mean, the tax evasion charges, I totally understand that case, not just because I tweet, fuck the IRS, every 6 months like clockwork, making my husband super pissed off because he thinks they're going to audit us.
He is now moving to the non-married filing jointly status.
Yeah, right? He's like, who's this Liz Wolf lady?
Lots of Liz's,
never heard
lots
of her.
Wolf. No. I'm Elizabeth Wolf with no E. That's my wife.
She's, like, squatting at my address. Get this bitch off. No. But, the tax evasion charges, though, I think it's fair to say that, A, he's a libertarian hero, but B, he did pay them back in full. You know, we do have a protocol for what happens when people, either because of malicious intent or incompetence, have some sort of issue with paying their full taxes to the IRS, right? Like, Hunter has, you know, he has been made whole in that realm. So I think that that's very fair. We can talk more about the drug and gun stuff, but... in your mind, like, why does this span all the way back to 2014? Is the date an accident?
No, I think it's on purpose. I think because they assume, I think Biden is assuming that DOJ, under the leadership of Bondi and FBI with Cash Patel, are going to investigate Burisma, even though it has been investigated ad nauseum. And there have been no evidence that Joe Biden did anything wrong. And really no evidence, I think, that Hunter Biden did anything wrong, at least legally do anything wrong. I mean, ethically, that's a different story. So I think this is a way to protect him from these investigations. And here's the thing. If I was on this enemies list of Cash Patel, I'd be less worried about a prosecution. I'd be much more worried about the investigations. And the investigations, in a sense, are the punishment. Because, you know, to face a DOJ investigation, to face a federal investigation means, you know, your life is going to be scrutinized. You're going to end up spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees. I mean, I think the idea here is that the investigations, in a sense, are the way to intimidate and to go after Trump's opponents. And I think that's what he's trying to protect against. I don't think this is about protecting Joe Biden. I think this is about protecting Hunter Biden from future investigations because the Republicans are obsessed with this idea that somehow Joe Biden benefited from Hunter Biden's business dealings in the Ukraine, which again, we've gone over this for now, what, 7-8 years now, back to since the Ukrainian impeachment, and there's nothing to it.
I think two things here, though. I mean, one, I think it's a little bit, we act like it's a foregone conclusion that Trump would go after Hunter Biden. I think it's also possible he might show leniency toward Hunter Biden, right? Like, that's something that I think is worth considering. But the other thing is just, like, I think maybe I'm crazy, but I feel like repeated investigation of possible corruption and influence peddling is kind of a great thing because I think we have far too much of that among political power players. And yeah, I understand what you're saying. If like, are they attempting to do death by a thousand cuts here in, frankly, much the same way that I think you could say Trump has been forced to handle. But I just keep coming back to this idea that there's really Hunter Biden's wrongdoing, I think, is so vast and expansive. And I really don't think that the American people should be forced to be so concerned with whether or not he relapses. I think it's perfectly fair to say, hey, it seems like a really big problem when we have the 50-year-old children of sitting presidents who are getting off scot-free when they've done so many things wrong repeatedly.
He hasn't.
Really?
He has been subjected to investigations that no other... I mean, on the gun charge in particular, this is a case that's almost never prosecuted.
There have been, 133 prosecutions over the last, I'm trying to think the time period, like 15, 20 years? 133
right, but
charges.
It is usually associated with another underlying crime.
I think 133 charges from 2008 to 2017, so a roughly 10-year period. So you are correct there.
So I think he has been targeted. I'm sure that Biden feels that he's been targeted unfairly because of Biden's own political aspirations. I think that probably creates some guilt for him. I don't really agree that he's committed an expansive amount of crimes. I think he has been targeted. Now, I actually think Hunter Biden been treated unfairly. Now, that doesn't really bother me so much in the sense that, you know, he went to trial, he was found guilty by a jury of his peers, he should be held accountable. And in another scenario, I probably, you know, if Harris had won or Biden had been reelected, I'd have a problem with pardoning Hunter Biden. But I think in this, I'd have a bigger problem, I'd say. I think in this situation, when you consider just the potential for what the Trump people can do, and look, you may be right, maybe they'll do nothing, maybe they'll show leniency, but the evidence would suggest otherwise. The evidence would suggest they're going to go after their political opponents. I mean, you don't put someone like Cash Patel in charge of the FBI unless that is your intent. Or at least I think that's a reasonable inference to make.
But Hunter Biden isn't really a political opponent of them, right? Like, this is a means of embarrassing the Biden family.
James Comer spent how many years in the House trying to find a way to go after Hunter Biden and the entire Biden family?
Well, the thing that I think is interesting here is part of the reason why so few of these like 922G charges that are brought. The reason why there's only 133 people over like a 9 or 10 year period with these charges is because it's very, very hard for the federal government to guess at who is a drug user and who is also purchasing a gun. Hunter Biden is so stupid that he just straight up admitted it, right? I mean, it was obvious.
Outside of Whole Foods or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. His girlfriend threw a gun. Like,
it's not a super criminal.
I'm sorry, but like the reason why this is a notoriously hard. These are hard charges to bring because, look, if I smoke weed in private...
Because the other people sometimes evade.
If I smoke weed in private when I go to buy a gun, look, they have no way of actually sussing out that, like, unless they smell it in my hair. But Hunter Biden is so stunningly incompetent at some of these basics. I mean, he's playing Fleet Foxes while he gets the fucking lap dance that, like, he can't figure out how to not be one of those unlucky 133. I'm sorry, but...
Prosecutor said this guy has been through drug addiction. He's not worth prosecuting this. That prosecutor would have faced so much criticism and scrutiny from Republicans, and that certainly could have been an impetus for him to seek a prosecution against Hunter Biden in this case. I mean, I think it's impossible to disconnect the Republican attacks, the constant attacks over the past 4 to 5 years against Hunter Biden from these prosecutions. And so I think when Joe Biden says that he is being unfairly targeted, he has a point. And from that perspective, I think, again, I go back to what I said earlier. I think if you're Joe Biden, you look at this and you say, my son, who has suffered so much, who lost his mother, who lost his sister, who lost his brother, has been attacked because he is my son. And I can't bear to watch him go to prison because of things that I did or because of my political ambitions. And, you know, I can't really defend it on the merits. I think, you know, Mike, you have a point on it is an undermining of the rule of law. But I guess for me, maybe I'm just really empathetic, but I just look at this and I say, when I look at what, not to say you're not empathetic, guys, but I'm just thinking, I'm overly empathetic.
Right.
I'm a proud hard-ass. As a mother, I am a proud hard-ass mom, and I intend to stay this way.
Cohen shows up in the job interview when asked about his flaws.
I'm too empathetic. I hear that all the time from people.
Yeah. Are you too organized also?
No, that I'm not. No, that, I don't have to worry about that, but empathy.
I'm sorry, you are disqualified to be the executioner.
So I guess for me, it's like when I feel these criticisms of, and I think, okay, you got a point, but at the end of the day, I kind of feel sorry for the guy, and I kind of feel sorry for Hunter Biden, and I kind of feel sorry for his dad, and I feel sorry for what they've experienced, and I don't know. I feel like I'm not that upset about it.
Michael, you said earlier that there's no evidence, and let's nitpick. I think there's some evidence, but there's certainly not proof or enough chargeable proof that Hunter Biden broke the law or that Joe Biden benefited from his time in Burisma. But of course, Joe Biden benefited from it. When your son gets an extremely high paying job, and to use the phrase that was exonerative or exculpatory, it was inculpatory in this sense. The only reason he got the job, a very high paying job, was that his last name was Biden. When your son benefits like that, that does accrue to the president, and especially when the president, especially when the president is in charge with rooting out corruption, there was a case to be made that Joe Biden never did anything that was corrupt. But this is another, or if you want to argue, at least a corrupt act regarding his son, the benefits he got from being a Biden. And I think it a little bit takes some of the ballast under the argument that he only engaged in a virtuous way when he was in charge of being the anti-corruption vice president.
There's never been any evidence that he didn't act as a public servant.
What I just said is his son benefited. And when you're a dad, you want your son to make hundreds of thousands of dollars and get his life.
But let me say this. I disagree a little bit. I think any benefit that Biden personally, Joe Biden, accrued is outweighed by the political cost of his son being, you know, for lack of a better word, kind of a fuck up. So I think that has not helped him. And I think Joe Biden would be much better off if Hunter Biden had a job at the post office than if he had gone around the world trying to use the Biden name to benefit himself. I don't think it's really been a benefit for Joe Biden. And I don't think it probably helped undermine some of his support, and certainly undermine support with Republicans, because of the assumption that he was sort of doing things to help his son.
If he'd had a job at the post office, he would have mailed so much cocaine, right? The entire system is consumed.
And frankly, who could blame him? But yeah. that reality is, you know, I think it'd be better politically for Joe Biden.
If he was at the post office, would he be kicking up 10% of the last mail to the big guy? I don't know. All right, we're going to take a break. Back with more Michael Cohen and Liz Wolf to talk. Well, in that last segment, Democrats didn't do well. In the next, they'll do even worse. Back with Not Even Mad. And we're back with Not Even Mad. We have Liz Wolf here. We have Michael Cohen. You know that because it's a podcast, not like you went anywhere. But we're going to talk about why the Democrats lost, or nationally, the Senate still can't retain the House. And my favorite analysis of this, not one that I bought the most, but the one that collected all the arguments in one place, was by this guy who wrote a very good book called Never Been Woke, Musa al-Gharbi. And he did a Substack post called A Graveyard of Bad Election Narratives. And the bad narratives include racism, sexism, revolt of the elites, successful scapegoating of trans immigrants, bad Democrat messaging on trans and immigrants, over-reliance on vibes, over-reliance on Liz Cheney, implausible tack to the center by Kamala Harris, no substantive economic agenda, an inflationary economic agenda. So there's something for everyone to pick from, even the ones that are self-contradictory. Liz, I think we started with you. Michael, I'll start with you this time. Do you buy any of these? Is this a useful exercise, an expunging among Democrats such as yourself?
I mean, the rending of garments by Democrats over the past couple of weeks has been beyond frustrating, and has been just, you know, I think, divorced from the reality of what happened in this election. I think there's a very simple explanation for what happened in this election. And I go to this chart that I saw, I think it was like election of the night after, from the Financial Times, that point out that every single incumbent party around the world lost voter share this year. You know the last time that happened? Never. It's never happened. Okay, so you have this anti-incumbent wave across the globe. You have a deeply unpopular president in Joe Biden. Those two factors, I think, are the single best explanation for why it is that Donald Trump narrowly won. And let's be honest, he narrowly won. This is the fifth lowest margin of victory for a president in the last 100 years. Won by, I think it's a 1.5, 1.4 now. And I'd actually make the argument, I made this case a couple days ago at MSNBC, that if you look at the national numbers, basically it was a 6-point shift in the popular vote from Biden's victory in 2020 to Trump's victory this time. Look at the swing states, it was much more narrow. The places where Harris actually, it's like around 3 points, 3.2, 3.3. I'd make the case that actually Kamala Harris won the campaign and lost the election. In the places she actively campaigned, she did better than the national average. Places like Wisconsin and Michigan and North Carolina and Georgia. She got more votes than Biden, in, I think, in all four of those states. Nevada. So I think that there was just impossible headwinds for Democrats to deal with. I think Harris ran a relatively good campaign considering all of the issues she had to deal with, not to mention coming on board 100 days or so before the actual election. And I don't think the Democrats should – I wrote this piece afterwards, The Case for Doing Nothing. I wrote this on my Substack, Truth and Consequences, that I just think the Democrats should look at this and say, you know, inevitably this was a close election that was a lot to do with inflation, a lot to do with post-COVID angst, anti-incumbency, and that you have to assume that Donald Trump is going to screw up. I call it the Donald Trump fuck-up watch, which I've just heard on my newsletters. I think he's just going to keep making mistakes, and there'll be a backlash, and that's how Democrats will benefit. And you can say that I'm crazy and say that I'm whistling past the graveyard, but we've seen this in cycle after cycle, right? So from 2012 to 16, 2024, we went Democrat, Republican for the presidential. That hasn't happened since the 1890s. We are in a period of a narrowly divided electorate in which small swings in these swing states tend to decide who ends up becoming president. And if I were the Democrats, I would just oppose everything Trump does, sit back, wait for him to screw up, and reap the benefits.
Liz.
Do you think Tim Walz was a good Veep choice?
Look, I don't think Veep choices ever matter, but my God, was Walz bad. If you think about it, like, look at Minnesota. Klobuchar crushed in Minnesota, and I think won by 7 or 8 points more than – did 7 points better than the Harris-Walz ticket. The guy's governor of the state. I mean, that's pretty bad. I do think this was
– he's a knucklehead.
He's just – whatever. He's fine. I mean, I don't have – I mean, the vice presidents don't matter. They never matter, so I don't think it matters all that much. But look, I think, you know
– never matter, even though it was Kamala Harris who was elevated by nature of her vice presidency, right?
They never matter.
Except when we're scrambling to find a replacement
candidate. That's fair.
150 days before the election. Like, I don't know. Arguably, this election made the case that, holy shit, maybe they do matter. Oh, no. Maybe we should take it seriously.
You know, they matter when they end up being elevated to the top of the ticket. Yes.
I mean,
I take the position that I think Kamala Harris ran a pretty good campaign, and she overperformed the places where she campaigned the most aggressively.
Okay, I struggle majorly with this, perhaps because I was subjected to watching like an hour of that god-awful Call Her Daddy appearance, and then the other Brené Brown appearance, and it's just. It really bothered me that one of the narratives that took hold following Harris's defeat was that she just failed to introduce herself and tell her life story to voters. I mean, the DNC this year was entirely about telling her life story to voters, right? Like, it was trotting out all of the extended family members, trying to show a beautiful blended family, you know, trotting out some footage of her and Doug and her McDonald's shifts and her time at Howard. And it's just like, I'm sorry, the entire focus of this convention was trying to make her life story feel relatable, make her feel approachable, try to not portray her as somebody who is like an insider to San Francisco politics, but rather somebody who really, you know, maybe you can relate to if you're also just a working woman in Georgia. I mean, she, I think, royally failed, and it's very frustrating to me that the narrative, at least from many Democrats, keeps coming back to like, oh, well, she just like didn't have enough time to prepare. She's had so many years of preparing for this. And the Biden administration, I think, frankly, did her a massive disservice, not by bringing her in so late in the game, which is another example of Biden's hubristic tendencies, but by not doing a very good job of actually including her or elevating her in any meaningful policy making. They gave her the shitty grunt work, right? They gave her the position of border czar during their term. And
Michael and I are going to lose our minds if you use that phrase. They told her that she was responsible
for fixing the
dealing
underlying
with countries at the border.
For fixing the underlying problems, right? You know, as if she would suddenly be able to fix all Northern Triangle country problems. Like, it's just, they gave her, you know.
She couldn't, like, breathe her magic Honduras pixie dust to solve that one.
Yeah. But they you know, set her up to fail. She was doomed to failure from the start. And I think it's really a sign of either maybe Biden be feeling threatened by her or somebody within the Democratic Party failing to anticipate what future years would look like. But I'm sorry, you kind of do have to plan for the future. And I think Harris had multiple opportunities to show what she was all about. She seemed to have some fire to her when she's talking about abortion rights. She seemed to, I think she did an all right job with attempting to sort of sell her upbringing as this like middle class background, as somebody who sort of understands the struggles of the working and middle class. But fundamentally, especially her sort of co-opting some of the Biden points about, well, really, like the reason that inflation is happening is because of, you know, corporate greed. Like, it didn't actually really resonate with people, nor was there ever a very clear plan as to, hey, if you're hurting in the pocketbook, here's how we're going to make it better for you. She had that sort of like limp, flaccid housing policy proposal, which sort of is like subsidize a little bit of demand, but also try to incentivize developers to build
and
more.
The price gouging proposal but that actually, when it was criticized, it ran away from.
Are you fucking Elizabeth Warren? I'm sorry, but like I am trying to think about how to make ends meet with my family, and none of this resonated with me at all.
I'm going to push back really hard on that one because I think I disagree pretty strongly with that one because – first of all, she spent more money on economic ads than Trump did, like $220 million.
I don't remember a single one of them, though, when I covered this campaign.
They were more economic ads than anything else she ran on. And I'm not – that's not me saying that.
That is true.
There's data to back that up.
Yeah, wrote about Future this Forward, the big pack, the gigantic pack that was supporting her did mostly economic ads. Yes.
Right. And if you look at the numbers in the swing states, her – people's views about her on the economy improved. Okay, they got better as it went along during the campaign. And so I go back to this point again. Look, she loses by almost six points nationally, a 6-point swing against her. But in the swing states, it was half of that, or maybe a little less than half of that. But it was basically around 3 points or so. In Wisconsin, for example, you know, Biden won by a point, Trump won by a point. And my argument is that in these places where she really actively campaigned, where she put the most money and time into it, she did better than she did nationally. And that tells me she ran a pretty good campaign that actually did move voters on her behalf. I think her problem was that she didn't move enough voters to win. But also, and I think this is the thing people don't talk about, Trump being on the ticket really helped Republicans. You know, I talk about this a few times now. In 4 states, Democratic Senate candidates won where Trump also won. Okay, that's happened 1 time in the past 2 cycles with Susan Collins in Maine in 2020. And so what that tells me in part is that you know, a lot of voters came out there and they were like, we're going to vote for Trump. I'm not going to vote for anybody else on the ticket. Like Michigan, for example. Why did Alyssa Slotkin win? I mean, you know, Trump got something. I think the Senate candidate got like 140,000 fewer votes than Trump did. In Nevada, it was like 70,000 fewer votes the Senate candidate, Republican Senate candidate did. You had a lot of Republicans, a lot of occasional voters who came out and said, I want to vote for Trump, but I'm not going to vote for another Republican. And that's how you have 4 senators in the Senate, Democrats in the Senate, that you wouldn't have had they all voted for
Right, but there's some data that rebuts that on the gubernatorial level, like in North Carolina. I just want to say...
Well, but think about the candidate he ran against, right? I mean, it was Nazi Africa guy.
I want to push back really fast, or just like a coda that I would attach to. It's like, which economic policies, like accepting that what you say is true with regard to these voter shifts and the economic ad spend, which economic policies are you saying really resonated with people?
I think it was twofold. I think it was one, going after Trump for being too close to billionaires, for giving tax breaks to billionaires. I think the price gouging thing, they ran a lot of ads on that.
But what I'm saying is that the price gouging thing, like, do we actually have much evidence that this sort of like met people where they're at?
She even backed off that. She even rewrote that proposal when it was criticized, rightly criticized.
Yeah, I mean, if you want my honest opinion, I think it's probably more the anti-Trump ads that he was basically, you know, going to give tax breaks to his buddies. I think that probably had a bigger impact than the positives she ran.
So then I just want to address a couple of ways you excellently laid the groundwork, that the whole world did shift against incumbents. But we didn't think, you know, in 2020, Joe Biden got 7 million more votes than Donald Trump. I don't think we went into this thinking that Kamala Harris was going to get 10 million more votes, but she did get 2 million fewer votes. So somewhere in between there was the path for Kamala Harris to win. You could still win and have the incumbent party get fewer votes. It would have been hard. Then again, in the rest of the world, incumbent parties didn't have the baggage of Donald Trump. So I do think it was possible. I'll concede she didn't run a historically disastrous campaign. There's a lot that we can rightly criticize, but I do think. But if the Democrats were to listen to you, should their message and takeaway just be better luck next time? By the way, I know next time is going to be the midterms and they will do better, but there's no real fundamental changes in messaging or in actual policy that they could latch onto, because I think they are. And I think the brand's toxicity in much of the Midwest or just non-coastal America is real. And a lot of it is fair. Some of it isn't, but a lot of it is fair.
Okay, I'm going to take that one on. 2016, Democrats lost. They lost all these Senate races. They lost all the blue wall states. 2 years later, they take back control of the House. They win 40 seats in the House. How'd they do it? They changed their messaging? No, people. It's a midterm. People didn't like Donald Trump. They didn't like how incompetent his administration was. And there was a backlash. You saw it in 2022, and that's why Joe Biden was elected. You saw it in 2022 to some extent also because of lousy Republican candidates. So I'm just saying that I think people overestimate sometimes, the what happens in these elections. Sometimes it's just a small swing in voter preferences. And I'm just saying I think that the likelihood of Trump overreaching in the next 2 years, of pissing off voters, of governing incompetently, which you're already seeing in the transition with already with Gates having dropped out, and I'm sure Hegseth very soon, that there's going to be a backlash.
Yeah.
I mean.
Of course, yeah. It always goes back and forth. But don't you think the Democrats need to be in a position where they say, despite all the trends of the world, despite what the statistics tell us about people's reaction towards inflation, we have to be able to be in a position to beat a candidate like Donald Trump, or specifically like Donald Trump. I think that shouldn't be a wish of Democrats. That should be a necessity. And the reason why they weren't in that position largely was because of choices they made.
I think it's because of Trump. I hate to say it. I mean, I'll give an example of this. I remember I saw something. I know Alyssa Slotkin, and I went to grad school with her. I like her. She's a nice person. She had this whole thing about how she sort of figured out how to run this more centrist campaign, and that's why she won Michigan. She got fewer votes than Harris did in Michigan. Okay? She got fewer votes. Why did she win? Because a lot of Republicans who voted for Donald Trump didn't vote for her. And it's painful to say this, but I do think that there is something about Trump that appeals to monkey-brained Americans, so they want to vote for him, and they do, and that's why he won in 2016, and it's why he won this time. I think if I'm a Republican, I'd be very concerned that you can recreate what Trump did this cycle 4 years from now. I'm not so sure they
can.
We're
really going to call them monkey-brained Americans? Really? Does that seem like a winning strategy? You're like, here's how we
win the left. Hey, I don't work Democratic Party. I don't work Democratic Party. I can say whatever I want to say.
So one thing that comes to mind here, I'm curious about...
Come on. They don't have prehensile tails.
I'm curious about what you make of the vast gain in support for Donald Trump that he experienced across all five boroughs of New York City. Like, what do you make of the fact that New Yorkers seemingly, I mean, obviously New York is sort of like the only place that matters, right? Everybody else is country rube. But no, I think it's really interesting, right? Like, I am unfortunately a Trump voter this time around, monkey brain Trump voter here, and I live in Queens. I warmed to this prospect after initially opposing him in 2016. I didn't vote for him any other opportunity that I've been offered. And this time I did, in fact, pull the lever for him. But what do you make of the fact that it wasn't just me? I wasn't the only New Yorker doing that. It was actually a massive shift across. You look at the really granular neighborhood level data across all five boroughs. And with the exception of places like Park Slope, you see this massive shift. Like, what does that tell you?
I disagree. And I'm going to write about this, actually. I did the math on this. There's not a massive shift in New York. What happened in New York was the Democrats stayed home, right? I mean, this counts as a shift.
That's one of the ways to get a shift. Right?
It is true. But this idea, and New York Magazine had a piece that basically argued, oh, there was this big shift toward Trump. Not really. I mean, I think in the Bronx, you could argue there was a relatively large shift. In Queens, it was like 12% increase in votes.
That's a lot. Isn't that a lot, right?
Like, and they love not, AOC.
It's not insignificant, but as from a raw vote perspective, it's not very many. In Brooklyn, it was like less than 10%. You know what actually was the second largest shift of all the boroughs? Oddly enough, was Manhattan, which I sort of find fascinating. I don't have a good explanation for why that is. Staten Island, there was virtually no shift.
Well, yeah, I mean, Staten Island is already a Trump strong.
I think he maxed out his Republican vote there. Yeah.
You're gonna say they're monkey brained, aren't you?
no comment. I just think in general that the shift, what happened in New York and some in California, like 40% of the drop off from her numbers from Biden came in New York and California. Of course, those two are the biggest states. But it just shows a lot of Democrats stayed home. Now, that's a problem for Democrats. I'd be very concerned why Democrats stayed home. But I don't know that it means that that California is suddenly in play. And I think maybe the emphasis on what happened in those places is a bit overstated as to how important it is in the long-term Democratic Party. You look at places like Milwaukee, places like Fulton County in Atlanta, she did better than Biden did. In North Carolina, around Raleigh-Durham and around Charlotte, she did better than Biden. So, and those are, you know, pretty, those are important communities. So I think that we can tend to overstate how much of a shift this really was and sort of realize that I think what really happened here was that a lot of Democrats were just disenchanted with the way the country was going and they stayed home. Doesn't mean they all want to support Donald Trump. But then again, there are plenty of occasional voters who will vote for Trump who will not vote for other Republicans. We saw it in 2018. We saw it in 2020. We saw it in 2022. We've seen it down ballot. The man does not have coattails. I mean, he wins 6-point national shift, 6 points. And how many seats do Democrats pick up? Pick up a seat in the House. You would expect a 6-point shift in the presidential vote tally for Republicans to pick up some seats. They didn't. So I think that tells you something that this is a very much a sui generis to Trump, and he does not have coattails to help the party.
Legion, one last word?
I'm just curious about how you think, like, New York's 17th congressional district, which is obviously outside of the city, plays into this, right? We saw the defeat of Democrat Mondaire Jones. We saw Mike Lawler win. It's kind of an interesting district that people sort of, especially on election night, look at as this bellwether of, like, okay, well, it was a very close race, and there was a little bit of a sense of, like, this race is going to be called pretty early. And from here, we might be able to extrapolate and get a sense as to whether or not Republicans are performing well. But you look increasingly at the sort of makeup of New York, and it does. I mean, am I incorrect here to say that New York has long been regarded as this, like, extreme Democratic stronghold, including the city, including all parts of upstate? And in fact, people are kind of indicating consistently, and not just Long Island, but, like, people outside of Long Island in the city and in parts of upstate are indicating, actually, don't count on our support, Democrats. Like, we're not necessarily going, like, don't take us for granted.
My response would be, you know, she did a lot worse than Biden did in New York. And guess what? Democrats flipped 3 House seats in New York State. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's pretty significant. And as far as New York City, I've lived here for 25 years. I've never understood people think this is a liberal bastion. I mean, I had Mayor Giuliani, I had Mayor Bloomberg, who frankly was the best mayor I ever had in the city for 12 years. Eric Adams, who is maybe the worst mayor, was really saying something, ran on a much more conservative platform than other Democrats did. I mean, the most liberal mayor that won here was de Blasio. So I think this is not a liberal bastion and hasn't been for really ever to some extent. It's always been a pretty conservative element in New York City.
Do you think that Harris should have gone on Rogan? Do you think that would have helped or hurt?
I mean, you lose by 6 points nationally. I can't imagine going on Joe Rogan helps all that much. She should have done it. I would have done it. But I also don't know that I don't think it makes enough of a difference. But yes, I think she should have gone on.
Is the if the offer is extended, you'll take it, Colin?
To go on Rogan?
Yeah, you said it. You would have done it. Give me the shift.
Sure. If he promotes my Substack, I'll absolutely give you the boot. Sure, why not? It's like how many million people watch that podcast? Right. I don't really get the appeal of Joe Rogan, but people like him, I guess.
I think my problem is I could never go on the show because I get the appeal too much. I think I would be like a little too excited.
Would they serve you free bourbons and then it's all talking about MMA grappling holds? Yeah.
Be like, can you show me your biceps?
Now we come to the point in the show where we talk about the things that grind our gears, the things that get our goats. These are our goat grinders. I'll start. I'll lead the template. I'll give the template. You know, it's been said and is still being said that the Republicans and Donald Trump are increasingly unhinged, increasingly vindictive, increasingly untethered to reality. Here's the thing. Donald Trump is unhinged and untethered to reality and all those things. It's just not increasing. He's reached a plateau. He's set the standard, you could say. But for some reason, we have to say increasingly, or we had to, and I thought this was a pre-election phenomenon to get people more worried or more riled up. But now that Donald Trump is very much doing what he did the first time, which is throwing out their names for people who could serve in cabinet positions that just make the head explode. Now that he's doing that again, his choices are said to be increasingly unhinged, increasingly off the reservation. Why do we have to do this? Can't we just say that this is the reality? It doesn't have to be a worse reality than before. It is the reality, and the reality was pretty bad. So that's what I'm calling out. The unnecessary increasing, and this is the one increasingly that's true, the unnecessary increasing use of increasingly. Donald Trump is just is. Doesn't mean it's good, but it doesn't mean it's going up or down, as the case may be. Liz, you got a goat grinder?
Mine is Pamela Anderson discourse. The thing that I'm really struggling with today, it's this discourse that I wasted probably like an hour on this morning when I was supposed to be filing a piece. But people have been talking about the quote unquote wall. Have you guys heard of this? The wall for women?
No. Like a wall at a certain age?
I suppose so. There's a great tweet from a guy who like seems very incel-y. Women truly do age like milk, especially white blondes. Ladies, get married and have children before it's too late. And then he has like a Pamela Anderson Baywatch image and then an image of her like, you know, in present year at like 57 where she looks like makeupless and older, but not like, not disgusting or despicable, and people are.
So it's a 30-year gap.
Yeah, I mean, this is, and also like this is.
It turns out that people age in 30 years.
This is kind of.
And has this guy never heard of Helen Mirren?
I know, right? Oh, or Diane Lane, or any of the others. I mean, the thing that is really bothering me about all of this is, I think we almost have this like allergy to women aging gracefully. It's as if now such a frequent thing that you see. And look, I'm a libertarian. I guess I'm in favor of the transhumanism. I have to say that, like, do whatever body modifications you want to. But it almost seems like people have gotten so used to a certain Botox-y look that the actual sight of a 57-year-old woman who's just, I mean, I don't know the degree to which she's gotten surgery. Or any sort of enhancements. But I mean, she looks natural and beautiful and lovely and absolutely radiant and like she works out. And I just cannot help but think that, first of all, the algorithm is manipulating all of us into wasting so much fucking time on this. That way China can get ahead and destroy us all. But also, it's just like, can we not appreciate the good things in life? I mean, Pamela Anderson looks absolutely beautiful. Like, have you seen Selma Hayek? I'm sorry. These are just gorgeous women aging gracefully. And I think, frankly, we're in this era of doing all of these goddamn movie reboots time and time again. And what we really need is a reboot of The Graduate or a resurgence of appreciation. Because I'm sorry, but like Mrs. Robinson, this is an aesthetic ideal that we just have to bring back. And I say this is against my interest. I'm a 28-year-old young woman. I have a long time, allegedly, before I hit the wall. But I think we need appreciation for beautiful, sexy 57-year-old women.
There's Liz Wolf with her pitch for 30 Rock's original idea of MILF Island. Michael Cohen, what do you got for us as your go grinder?
I just want to say I concur with everything Liz just said. Everything. Okay. It is 2 o'clock here in New York City, and in 2.5 hours, it will be dark. This is, I cannot tell you, there's not a single policy issue that annoys me more than daylight savings, than the fact that it gets dark at 4:30 in the winter. It is the worst time of year. It's the most depressing time of year, and you want more sunshine, not less. And I read this recently that this dog and pony show, Doge, which is the Elon Musk, Vivek Ramaswamy kind of thing, their efficiency thing. They want to change daylight savings. Look, I'm a Democrat, okay? I vote for Democratic candidates. But if they can get this thing shifted, if Republicans can do this, they might get my support in the next election. This is how strongly I feel about daylight savings. It has to stop. I guess it's extending daylight savings, I think, is the way it's
right. The solution is to go to permanent daylight savings.
Now. Exactly.
Yes.
We need more sunshine in the winter. We need it desperately in this country. As a Northeasterner for my entire life, we need it. make this change. It just drives me crazy that and everyone agrees on this, by the way. This is like, I'm not crazy. This isn't some crazy liberal fantasy. People agree on this. I think Marco Rubio was like the guy in the Senate who was pushing this.
Yeah.
This is a bipartisan thing. Make it happen.
It would affect our lives and cut
in
through everything.
In such a positive way. In such a positive way.
And can we get, you just hit one of my two favorite issues. The second one is the elimination of pennies. But can we save that for the next time?
Yes, so, elimination of pennies. That's a good one. That's a good one.
I want to thank you, Liz Wolf, and you should check out her Reason podcast and YouTube channel, Just Asking Questions, and Michael Cohen, whose Substack is, of course, the great, I forget the name of the Substack, what is it?
Truth and Consequences. It's so great you can't remember the name of it.
And Michael Cohen, who is the author of the great Substack, Truth and Consequences, and MSNBC contributor. Liz, Michael, until next time, I'm not saying we're right, I'm not saying we're wrong, I am saying we're not even bad. And that's it for Not Even Mad. This music, the music you're hearing now, was written by Max Kerman. Michelle Pesca is the CBSO of Peachfish Productions. Corey Wara cut together this show, as he does all of our audio. Joel Patterson is the senior producer of Peachfish Productions' Gist podcast. And also this one, Leo Baum. Yeah, he's our intern here, too. I hope he's not double-dipping. Until next time, we're not saying we're mad, we're not saying you're mad, but we are saying we're not even mad.
20 MILFs, 58th grade boys, no rules. And tonight, one winner. Welcome to MILF Island.
All right.
Aw, you suck.
This show is the worst. Didn't one of those MILFs die during production?
She had too much champagne and a monkey knocked her into some quicksand. It could happen anywhere.